Okay, so first thing, can you tell us your name, your position at the ECCC, and a brief summary of what you were doing there?
So my name is Tariq Abdulhaq. I worked at the ECCC from 2008 to 2014. I was first a senior court manager for a year, and then a senior assistant prosecutor for 5 years. And in that second role, I was involved in the prosecution of cases 001 and 002, and as well as the judicial investigations in cases 003 and 004.
Excellent. And what brought you to the ECCC in that role?
So I had been working at the Bosnian War Crimes Chamber for about 3 or 4 years, and I became aware of the ECCC sort of springing into action. I actually visited Cambodia in 2007 and had an opportunity to interact with staff and some of the judges and prosecutors. I assisted with some of the early planning in terms of rules and procedures going towards running it as efficient a court as you can in a hybrid setting, because I had some experience in Bosnia. And so then I was very much tempted when more positions became available in 2008 to throw my hat in the ring. Because I had these two roles, and the challenges in the two roles were actually quite different. The first was more administrative and managerial, sort of planning and budgeting type challenges. And the other one is more with the substantive work. And I don't know whether you want me to focus just on the second one, which is to deal with the trials and investigations.
Let's start there. What were some of the challenges that you had in that role?
All right, so turning to my first role, when I arrived in Cambodia in early 2008, very little work had been done in getting the court to be trial ready. There were no courtrooms that were fully functional, certainly no trial courtroom in place. There was no translation budget. A lot of key staff had still yet to be recruited. And so the court was a long way away from where it needed to be to conduct its first trial. And of course, the trial of Duch, the first trial, was listed to start in the second half of 2008. So there were enormous challenges. And I put this largely down to poor planning on the part of UN appointed bureaucrats who essentially failed to map out the workload in terms of translation, the administrative support that the court was going to require. Areas like procurement of equipment, of systems, recruitment of key staff to run these systems, to operate complex judicial proceedings in three languages using electronic evidence presentation and the like. Most of that was not in place. It was, as I said, a court that had a long way to go. So those were the early challenges, as I recall, and think back to 2008, 2009. And to its credit, ECC proved itself to be very credible, very flexible, and good at adapting. So eventually we managed to get the right budgets, systems, equipment, nothing in place, and we were able to run that first trial from a technical administrative perspective without major problems. And then turning to, I suppose, my other role as prosecutor, which was the longer period of 5 years. Significant challenges. I think the court's procedural mechanisms were not initially geared adequately towards prosecuting cases of this level of complexity. So we had a very vaguely defined victim participation model, which had to be adjusted as the cases were progressing. We started off with an extremely wide, broad, and as I say, not very well defined victim participation model, and then that became more defined. Similarly, in the area of conducting trials themselves, whether judges took more of a role in questioning witnesses or whether that would be delegated to counsel. So we had a particular model in the first trial, and then we progressed to a different model in the second trial. And there was a lot of that kind of adapting by the court to recognize and manage the complexity of the trials that it was running. I think some of that could have been avoided if there had been better planning, frankly, and also better engagement with the other existing tribunals at the time and the application of existing models with a greater degree of flexibility to begin with, because essentially that's where we ended up. We ended up adapting to models that were far more comparable to a national criminal tribunal for the former Yugoslavia or even the National Criminal Court than where we started off. And I think we had significant challenges in that regard because we started with a fairly inflexible model to begin with.
Gotcha. So kind of following up on that to a certain degree, particularly your first role, were there parts of the court's makeup or procedure, rules or practices that you thought worked well? What do you think could use improvement? And if you have any kind of anecdotes to help illustrate either of those things, that would be great.
Sure. Well, what didn't work well was the use of UN's bureaucratic systems and procedures to run this court. The UN is an old bureaucracy. It's not very efficient. I think I'm saying it's particularly controversial when I say that. And courts such as this need to be nimble. They need to be able to plan and execute their mission quickly. You have people in custody. You can't take forever to procure equipment and recruit staff, etc. So one of the things that spring to mind is we set out to buy equipment, and anything you procure in the UN system, I think the timeline we were given at the time was 6 to 9 months to buy or procure a service, for example, medical evacuation, or equipment such as AV systems for the courtrooms or evidence management systems for the various offices of the court. So those kind of timelines just did not work well and were not adequate and didn't respond to the needs of the court. And so that certainly presented a problem. And it presented a problem not only at the beginning, but also throughout the life of the court, insofar as, the UN is set up to do a lot of things, but one thing it's not really set up to do very well is run a criminal court.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about the hybrid aspect of the court. What are your thoughts about the positive and negative aspects of that?
Oh, look, I'm a big proponent of hybrid tribunals. I can certainly think of more positives than negatives. From positives, bringing international legal standards to a country that is still in the process of transition, engaging local actors and stakeholders, being, as people sometimes say, in theatre, being close to victims that are affected by the crimes, able to give access to those communities, being able to engage to some extent in what we sometimes call capacity building or skill transfer, even though that's not really always the primary focus of these tribunals. But to me, these are all enormous benefits. Justice is about responding to wrongs done to a community, and we are better to deliver that justice than in the community in which the crime first still happened. So I think those are all enormous positives. You could keep going. The international community gets to learn more about the country that it's engaging in. We as prosecutors, as defence counsel, as judges have a better understanding, I think, by living in the place where these crimes are said to have taken place. I think we do a better job overall by understanding cultural nuances, more about the history, the language, and all of those kind of things that happen by a process of osmosis, which, just wouldn't happen if you're living in The Hague and doing a language course and a history course about Cambodia. So those are all the positives, and I'd say they far outweigh the negatives. I don't think there are too many negatives of a hybrid model in theory or in principle. But if you talk about ECC in particular, at the risk of being controversial, a hybrid model works where there is political will on the part of both the international community and the state stakeholders in making it work. And so a court needs to be left to do its work, to interpret its own jurisdiction, to develop its own rules, and to conduct its own investigations and prosecutions within the mandate that is given to it by statute. I think you'd be naive to say that any international or hybrid court is entirely free from political interference or political realities. But I think the ECC has probably faced greater challenges than most of the other courts. And that's partly to do, I think, with the fact that the mandate of the court was not really very clearly defined in the statute, and the mechanisms for the resolution of disputes were not clearly defined and not sufficiently defined. So it enabled, if you're cynical, it enabled both parties to pursue agendas which they thought were consistent with the court's mandate, and that I think ultimately was to the court's detriment, because the controversies often overshadowed a lot of the very good work that was being done.
Yeah, certainly that makes a lot of sense. Thank you for sharing. Maybe kind of keeping some of those things in mind, are there lessons learned or best practices that you experienced at the ECCC, or recommendations that you'd have for future tribunals? I'd be particularly interested to hear about some of the setup procedures, as that's something a lot of folks have mentioned that perhaps could have been done differently.
What procedures?
So the setup. So in your first role, I guess.
Let me continue to be controversial on this, just on the point about the overall structure of the court, mm-hmm. And the process, and then I'll come to maybe the more technical side.
Sure.
I worked at the Bosnian War Crimes Chamber before I worked at the ECC, and the model that was adopted there, not that it was without its problems, but I think it served better the ultimate objective of conducting trials that were both free from any interference, but also seemed to be free from any interference. And the key aspect of that model is that and this is the controversial aspect, mm-hmm. In all of the chambers that heard war crimes cases and organized crime cases, because that tribunal did both, there was a majority of internationals. And equally, the officers were originally, the registry, the prosecution office, etc., were headed by internationals. That's not because internationals are amazing and brilliant and deliver something that national professionals can't deliver, but it's to ensure that there is both the actuality and the appearance of a court that is free from any possibility of political pressure being put on it by the realities of the country in which it's operating, and the fact that the country is developing its approach to rule of law and developing its independent judicial institutions. And I think there's something to be said for a model whereby there is that initial period where, by default, there is a lead given to the international component, with a very concrete program for a transition to shared ownership, and then ultimately to full national ownership. That's what happened in the Bosnian model. Now, as I say, the Bosnian model isn't without its problems, but it and perhaps that sort of a model would never have gotten off the ground in Cambodia, given the realities of the political climate in Cambodia. But it is a way of institutions from the actuality and the perception of political interference by having that clearly defined international character in the first phase of its life. Now, in terms of the setup, there's a few practical things that I would say about the Cambodian experience. One, ditch the French language, not because I don't like the French language. The idea of having two foreign languages imposed enormous financial constraints and requirements on the ECC. Not many people know that the translation budget in the early years of the ECC competed with and was possibly greater at times than the budget for the legal staffing of the court. And the reason for that was, and the reason for that is that the translation between English and French can only be done by international UN accredited translators, who in the UN system are rated or ranked at the same level as trial attorneys. So I, as a prosecutor, was at a particular level of seniority in the UN system, and at the same level of seniority were revisers of translations and interpreters who were sitting in the simultaneous interpretation booths, translating and interpreting between two international languages, which are of no relevance to the experience of the Cambodian victims and the Cambodian community. So that's why I said ditch the French. I mean, I could have just as easily said ditch the English. And I wrote an article about this. You've really got to stick with one international language, because the use of two languages adds enormous, just unbelievable costs that run into many millions of dollars a year. Money that could be better spent on victims' reparations or better staffing, et cetera, et cetera. That's one aspect. The other aspect that I felt quite strongly about is that the drafters of the ECC rules, and let's name them, they are the judges of the plenary of the ECC, set out to put in place a wide-ranging victim participation model, which I remember from the outset, I remember talking to people and saying, you've really got to decide exactly what it is that you're seeking to accomplish with this, and how you're going to do this in a trial in which potentially hundreds of thousands of people are victims. If you're seeking to apply a model where traditionally each victim has a right to be heard and to be represented by a lawyer, there was no thinking given to the idea of the grouping of victims, to the appointment of lead co-lawyers. All of these things happened during the life of the court. They caused enormous friction and controversy within the court because of the lack of that vision and a sense of what can realistically be done in the context of a trial, which involves elderly accused, limited resourcing, and, as I said, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of potentially eligible victims. And so that was another drain on resources and time of the court that I think could have been avoided if the victim participation model had been more clearly defined at the outset.
Yeah, absolutely. So thinking a little more about future courts handling mass atrocities like this, what challenges do you see those courts facing based on your time at the ECCC?
I'd say number one, adequate planning. What each of these tribunals requires when it's set up is a very careful mapping out of the expected caseload, the staffing requirements, requirements for investigations in the field, technical support requirements, how many courtrooms do you need, how many pages of documents are going to need to be translated, how many staff do you need for that, what sort of a detention facility might you require, and all of those types of things. I think planning is absolutely fundamental to setting up any future tribunal. And then almost in the same breath, I would say defining the rules of procedure, realistically, not as happened in aspects of the ECC rules by appealing to these kind of theoretical notions about what could be done, but realistically what can be done to manage a mass atrocity trial, to manage a fair and expeditious trial against the expectations of large numbers of victims. So technical and budgetary planning and the defining of rules that provide, let's say, for efficient conduct of proceedings. Those are probably the main challenges. And then I'm going to be controversial again, and I'm going to say appointing judges with extensive experience in conducting complex criminal trials. That's another one.
Definitely seem like good things to think about to me. So getting within the boundaries of what's been released to the public, can you recall any accused or survivor stories from the trials that particularly resonated with you?
I looked at the questions and I find it very difficult to speak of any individual account, because then I would feel like I'm leaving out thousands of other accounts that I came across of experiences of enormous suffering of victims. The best that I can do is talk about one individual that I interacted with both at court and the community, and I'm talking about the late artist Phan Nhat, who was a person who gave evidence in the first trial, the trial of Duch, and unfortunately passed away before the second trial commenced. So he was an enormously valuable witness, because his experience of the Khmer Rouge detention system was that of someone who went from, if I recall it correctly, from a commune or district level security center and then up the hierarchy of the security centers and all the way to S21, which from a prosecution perspective was extremely important, because it established a hierarchy and an internal sense of organization and coordination between regional security centers, including those at district and sub-district levels, and those based in the center and answerable directly to the party leadership. So it had enormous forensic value, his experience. But what struck me personally was a community forum that I attended in Kampot, where Phan Nhat spoke to the community. And I felt absolutely humbled to be in the presence of this person. And I was in awe of his wisdom, of his generosity, of the credible sophistication with which he spoke about what justice meant to him and why this court was so important to him and why people should support it. The way in which he spoke about the giving of evidence being an empowering experience, which is actually consistent with what you hear from witness support experts in the international domain, that the experience of giving evidence, whilst potentially traumatic, is also an empowering experience, because the voice of the victim is given center stage in court, and the victim is able to face his or her perpetrator and to be listened to. I could never do it justice. Phan Nhat spoke with such enormous, as I said, sophistication and nuance. And so that left a real lifelong impression on me, just sitting next to him, listening to him speak, and feeling completely and utterly humbled that I had this privilege of doing the work that I was doing, and to be sitting next to someone like him and listening to him speak.
Yeah, that is certainly a powerful powerful moment. Thank you for sharing it with us. So last question on our end. What do you think the major impacts of the ACCC will be on Cambodian society, both now and, say, about 20 years from now?
Look, I think you could... Well, there's obviously, you put the question in plural, and I think that's right, because there are going to be multiple significant, I think, impacts that the court will have had. First and foremost, I think the court has provided a careful, forensic, judicial accounting of the atrocities committed from 75 to 79 by looking at a reasonably representative sample of the atrocities. I think the court answered many questions about the origins of the ideologies that led to the violence, about the structure and the organization of the Khmer Rouge system, of the Communist Party of Kampuchea, of the way in which the experience of Cambodian victims had a direct causal connection with the policies and the ideologies adopted by the party leadership. So I think that is an enormous benefit, not only to Cambodia, but even more widely to the international community. The establishment of a carefully crafted and judicial record that is based on the testing of evidence to the highest standard available in any legal system beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think that is important. Flowing from that, I think the ECC was sort of a conduit for conversations more generally in Cambodian society about the Khmer Rouge period. Just living in Cambodia for the 6 years that I was there, I was able to see community forums, TV programs, various NGO initiatives geared towards having a discussion about what happened. Even forums looking at a dialogue between former perpetrators and victims, recognizing that in many cases the perpetrators were very young at the time of these events, that many of them were brainwashed teenagers when they were committing these crimes. So I think that sort of the presence of the court and its work acted as a conduit in encouraging these dialogues and activities, which I think continue and are really important. Beyond that, I think the ability of the Cambodian people to witness a functioning court that, as far as the trials that were conducted are concerned, did conduct its proceedings to the highest international standards, that respected the fair trial rights of the accused, that gave victims a voice, and that delivered sound judgments on law and on matters of evidence. I think witnessing and experiencing that, hopefully, is a catalyst to further reforms in terms of the Cambodian legal system on its road to full independence and full rule of law. Those are probably the main ones I can think of.
Great, thank you. Before we wrap up, is there anything we haven't talked about that you think it's important to note or that you'd like to say?
Look, I think maybe only one thing that the ECCC often gets a bit of a bad rap because of the political complexities that surround cases 3 and 4. And fair enough, there should be proper scrutiny of how those cases are dealt with by the court. But I think sometimes all of us in the international community fall into a bit of an ideological, intellectual trap of assuming that all tribunals, international and domestic and hybrid, are free from political interference or political realities. And I think with experience of 11 years of working in international or internationalized tribunals, I'm certainly of the view that all of these bodies are subject to political pressures of one kind or another. The ultimate test is how the court conducts itself in response to those pressures. The fact of the presence of those pressures to me is not where the analysis ends, but where it begins. One really has to look at what the court does, how its officers, its judges, the prosecutor and defence counsel respond to these challenges, and then pass judgment on whether or not the court has met its mandate. And I think if you look at the ECC through that sort of prism, I think you give it a far better assessment than what people sometimes do.
Sure thing. I thank you for noting that. I think it is, I agree it is important to kind of keep these things in mind. Well, thank you very much for speaking with us. We really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.